Here's what you can look forward to in today's episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think this has been talked about on the podcast a number of times, how difficult change is to implement and drive and within the industry. And, you know, there's lots of reasons behind that, you know, the status quo and professional risk and what if it doesn't work. And as a, you know, as an industry, we tend to be typically risk averse. Yeah, I mean, it was tough in the early days for sure.
Over the last decade, the market research industry has been disrupted. Our largest agencies are struggling to keep up as their customers turn to newer, faster, and cheaper data sources. Now, we are on the edge of yet another major market shift. Now is the time for us to reassert ourselves as the rudder of the brands we love. Thank you for tuning in to the Happy Market Research Podcast, where we are charting the path for the future of market researchers and businesses. Hi, I'm Jamin Brazil, and you're listening to the Happy Market Research Podcast. Today, my guest is Dave Carruthers, founder and CEO of VoxPopMe. VoxPopMe is a platform that is optimized and automates insights gained from video. Prior to founding VoxPopMe, Dave has worked extensively in tech dating back to 2001. Dave, thank you very much for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast today.
Thanks, Jamin. Looking forward to the next half hour for sure.
So, one of our core questions is, and it's driven by really the audience's interest, is how did your parents wind up impacting who you are today and ultimately the success that you've had with VoxPopMe?
I guess everything starts with our parents, our upbringing, our values, and it's kind of a bit weird because in my family, no one else was really entrepreneurial within business. But even as a young kid, I was always kind of, you know, setting up these businesses, whether it was washing people's cars in the neighborhood, or, you know, setting up a magazine or these kind of different things. I was always looking at, you know, ways to make money. I think the biggest impact in terms of career-wise was probably my father. He was a computer programmer, so that definitely kind of got me interested in technology from an early age. I remember kind of 7 years old getting a Commodore 64, which dates me somewhat, as a Christmas present, and kind of, you know, learning to write these basic programs on that device, and, you know, 10 go to 20, 20 run and all this kind of stuff. And it really kind of started my obsession with technology and what was possible. So from an early age, I would say kind of that influence there was massive for me.
Commodore 64. So that was actually my dream device growing up. My parents wouldn't support me for it though, unfortunately, because we went with the early adopter of Atari 2600.
Atari 2600. Yeah, no, I mean, it was great. I mean, I just remember playing Football Manager on there, and we had this army assault game, and yeah, just the amount of joysticks we went through, because they were, shake it left and right to run faster. And yeah, they weren't particularly robust back in those days. And yeah, the 27 minutes for the game to load as you put the tape in and stuff. Yeah, it's amazing to see where we've come now to, you know, VR and these immersive games we've got. And yeah, incredible, really.
And then you have this whole, you can actually make a living streaming nowadays, right? So it's a complete divergent path that I'm massively envious of.
Yeah. I think there's a famous cartoon about how you could make money playing computer games. And it was kind of satirical back in the 90s, I think it was. And then here we are today with, some of the best paid reality, you know, stars are, you know, Twitch streamers. We've got esports athletes, the world's changed completely for sure.
The whole Twitch thing. You've been obviously following some of the adoption of Twitch and how it's, I believe it's going to have, it'll eventually overshadow in the next 10 years what is professional sports right now. There's a lot of buzz around, like, LA specifically, thinking about, I think Blizzard created their own gaming area. EA has one for esports now as well, right? So it's just, there's a lot that's blowing up in that space. Have you been seeing any of that impact research?
Yeah, well, Twitch is actually a client of ours, so we've actually done quite a bit of work with them, getting to the voice of the gamer and stuff. Quite a lot of video feedback at events and capturing that, and also doing stuff within their platform to capture feedback on streams and things like that. So it's a really interesting space, and I think what you're seeing, all of these pro sports teams have now got their own esports teams, whether that be Madden teams or FIFA teams, or even Call of Duty, and obviously Fortnite as a phenomenon seems to have taken over now as well. So yeah, I think that medium, the thought that there's thousands of people watching someone play a computer game. I mean, for me, all it does is remind me of how bad I am at these various games. So I kind of tend to stay away from it. But it's certainly changed things for sure.
Yeah, I play Fortnite with my teenage boys about once every 2 weeks, and it is the most humiliating experience ever. And what's funny is I've always prided myself on being a particularly good gamer. So yeah. Right when World of Warcraft first came out, however long ago that was, 15 years or whatever, like 2000, is that right? Anyways, so maybe 2002. I was early in that game with alpha access, and then hardcore raiding nights, early mornings, Sunday mornings. It was a very exciting time. And then completely separated from that as I moved into the professional world in a big way. And now trying to like get back into it a little bit, it is definitely the wrong size shoe for my foot. It's completely embarrassing.
Yeah, for sure. I was back in England at Christmas last year, seeing family and things like that. And my lowest gaming point came as my 6-year-old nephew beat me at FIFA.
Don't you just want to punch him? I know he's only six, but there's a little bit of me is like,
Yeah, and the kid, yeah, he had so much attitude as well. So he was like, my brother was couldn't stop laughing. Yeah,
because it's so humiliating. It's hilarious. Are you seeing, so in the being early in the video space, as you have been, VR, AR, are you seeing entrance there or application there for research?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some really interesting stuff happening in that space. And I think the challenge has always been historically a couple of things. Has been, one is the cost to create these environments, and how do you create these virtual stores and things like that. There was it was starting at six figures, easy six figures and stuff to do anything. And now you're seeing more and more of this stuff being able to be put up and built, far, far, far quicker and stuff. So I think there's definitely an increase in that. And the challenge was always, how do you make this scalable? This isn't something that everybody has. You had to get people to central facilities and stuff. And whilst we're still probably there now in terms of that adoption curve, that not everyone has a VR set in their house, we're still starting to see things like Google Cardboard, and everyone's got a smartphone and different kind of entry points for VR and creating experiences that can be done. So I think like any new technology, the adoption is becoming more mainstream as the entry point comes down and the hardware is in more people's hands.
Have you done any personal, had any specific experience with VR?
Professionally or personally?
No, personally.
Personally, yeah. I mean, I've done quite a bit of, on the PlayStation Gaming 1, and then a few of the guys in our UK office have got pretty sweet kind of Oculus setups and stuff. One of the guys brought in kind of all the sensors and full surround sound and stuff. So we've had some good experiences with that in the office, and it's just, yeah, I mean, it's incredible. You kind of like, oh, it's just a game. And as soon as you put that headset on, you're just kind of completely immersed, and just our brain can't, the signals are all there. I mean, I think it's interesting to see, is it the company Magic Leap, with their new, You know, they've kind of raised hundreds of millions and yet to ship a product. And I think their first product just came out recently, and it was kind of a bit of a kind of disappointing experience. Or the, you know, certainly the reviews weren't great because it had been pretty hyped and stuff. But I know Microsoft have just announced a new kind of platform, and that merging of kind of AR with the real world stuff, rather than I think the AR applications and overlaying into real world environments is probably more interesting than the VR applications. How we can combine the digital and the physical. I think that's super interesting.
So there's 2 points there I want to piggyback on. One is, personally, this last Christmas, we purchased a Oculus for the family Christmas gift. And we went on Steam, got a horror game. Everybody put the Oculus on and experienced this like basic, very straightforward kind of walkthrough jump scare. And even though you knew at what point it was going to happen, it was so immersive that you would literally scream and almost fall over. Like, it was just like that, right? I mean, you could be the sixth person in line and you still believed it when you're in that environment. And I put environment in air quotes there, by the way, because as you know, it's just not quote unquote real. But I do think that what, you know, thinking about like what the focus group room looks like in 20 years from now will be completely different. And especially as companies like Magic Leap or whoever winds up driving it get that lightware figured out, it's going to be really impactful on for researchers.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, that ability to, you know, showcase different content in different environments, and, you know, it, as I said, it's just, it's becoming more scalable. And yeah, I'm excited to see where that goes.
My kids are going to be permanently scarred, which is the second point that I wanted to make. So I have a 3-year-old. We didn't let him wear the headgear, of course, but he was able to watch what was happening on the computer screen. So we were mirroring it. And it just happened. There was this like doll and its head would turn and follow you when you would walk through this room, of course, typical. And so he literally would, every time he would see it, he would like point at the screen and go, "Scary baby, scary baby." And so he still says "scary baby." I know.
You're going to be paying for that in later life.
Totally. That's why I actually have to keep working, yeah. Is because all the therapy that my children are going to be going through, having me as their father. It's very sad.
There you go.
But the augmented reality piece, I've seen a lot of, I've actually read quite a bit on how that will change our future. You know, Google Maps for me being probably one of the most easiest things to tether to. Yep. You know, I grew up in a world of Rand McNally, which is paper maps for those listeners that don't know. Merrill Dubrow, you do know. And so as you would travel around the country, you'd always have to stop at gas stations once you literally ran off the map. And, you know, Google Map now is just so much, has completely, there's just such a different point of reference on how easy it is to get around places, especially with traffic notifications and like Scout provided and whatnot. So that's very powerful. But then thinking about like the consumer purchase process with an augmented reality, the power really continues to get, whether it's just product reviews in real time on what you're viewing or pricing considerations. And it just keeps going on and on. You remember the old school shelf tests that we used to do, which were just like static images and yeah, click tracking. Now it's a lot more powerful. Have you looked at what Betty, I can't remember how you say her last name, Adamu, I want to say. She recently came out with a book called Games and Gamification in Market Research. Have you had a chance to look at that?
No, I haven't checked that out.
Yeah, I've been following her, and she's got an app that you can download, and it's basically just a story-based narrative that tracks consumer choices, and it's a surrogate for traditional conjoint. But again, to your earlier point, it's expensive and time-consuming, so it's not quite in line with what brands are demanding, which is, you know, feedback in 2 days versus 2 weeks or 2 months. So as that continues to, you know, as the gamification of research continues to get cheaper and faster, I'm convinced it's going to become a major part of how we wind up gathering consumer data.
Yeah, 100%.
So a large part of our constituents are employees or aspiring employees in the insights world. What if you were entering into this space in today's in a modern frame, what would be some of the things that you would do in order to secure a job in market research?
Yeah, I mean, I think so the one fascinating thing, and I noticed this from hearing, you know, a number of different people who've been on the podcast story, and is no one really ever seems to set out to get into market research. You know, very few people were, you know, age 10 and telling their careers advisor at school or whatever, you know, I want to be in market research. So people always seem to come into this industry through different channels. But I definitely think there was an interesting debate on LinkedIn yesterday, I think it was. I think Ray Pointer started it, but it was around how, what were the requirements of the market researcher today, and you know, how have they changed? You know, obviously the traditional skill set of the researcher is still you know, a huge part of that, but you know, there's almost like, you know, there's that facet that's important, those traditional softer skills, the psychology, the anthropology, that type of you know, inquiring mind. But I think now it's, you know, you need to have, you know, an element of a, you know, that data science background. You need to know some, you know, it's helpful if you know, you know, basic programming skills and things like that. So the ability to be able to, you know, hack data sources together, merge, you know, we're in a world where we've never had so much access to data from different third party sources. And I think as researchers now, it's incredibly important that we're able to merge, synthesize, rationalize multiple different data sets and see how they kind of correlate and interact and be able to derive insights from that. So I think there's you know, and it's one of the, you know, there's a real shortage of data scientists right now. You know, it's one of the, you know, top paying skill sets. It's because there isn't so many, you know, there isn't enough people. It's become such an important role for companies to be able to fill. There simply aren't enough, you know, graduates or people going through training to acquire those data science skills. So I would say if I was trying to get hired in the market research industry today, I'd double down on data science and really gen up in that area.
Yeah, we were just talking with GoDaddy and who was the other one? MasterCard yesterday. Both of those interviews talked about the need for data science, but scientists. But what's interesting is that role seems like it's fitting more and more with R&D and sometimes product, as opposed to underneath the purview of market research inside of brands. Are you, with your customer base, are your customers predominantly in market research, or are you seeing companies maybe in the user experience or data science area using VoxPopMe?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, predominantly our customers are in, you know, more in the insights, so on the insights and market research side of things. And I think that's predominantly because, you know, a lot of what we do, even though it's kind of qualitative at scale, it's still a very, you know, kind of qual type output within video, even though we're collecting, you know, video at a far larger scale than traditionally you would have done, and we're able to automate the analysis, we're able to quantify, you know, data from video, it's still not really a huge data science challenge. I also think because of this lack of shortage, this lack of data scientists within companies, most of them are in areas of the company like, you know, BI and analytics and kind of sitting in, you know, as you say, R&D and other departments, because potentially at this stage, that's where they can probably have the most impact. And maybe MR hasn't quite yet caught up to, you know, how it could be leveraging some of those skill sets more and, you know, combining, you know, multiple, you know, it's still, I think research is still very, very episodic in the main, and still very kind of, you know, single source or single study. And, you know, more and more, I think we're seeing brands looking at how can I merge, you know, transactional data with social data, with other streams of data, to be able to answer business questions without conducting primary research. So I think that's the change. It's with all this data, I think one of the things is it's not going to stop the research we're doing, but it's going to change the questions we're asking, and fundamentally the questions we shouldn't really need to be asking, because we have that data available. It's just we don't have the people and the skills to unlock that data effectively right now.
So this tethering of data to workflow is a theme that's been coming up for me over the last, I want to say, 5 years. But as I've been doing these interviews 3-4 a week, I mean, it's really punching through louder than I ever thought it would. And you hit on an interesting point, which is you're thinking about like UX research, that's part of product as opposed to market research, the market research division. And the reason it is, oftentimes, I think, is it works in lockstep with the cycle, the agile development cycle of the product team. And whereas research, to your point, fits perhaps more outside of that because of the length of time it can take to gather the insights. Is the utilization of video as relevant in the for UX researchers, or is it predominantly used for the storytelling inside of the insights division?
No, I mean, I think video has obviously been a massive part of UX for some time, and we're starting to see more and more clients leverage our technology alongside other more traditional UX tools. So, you know, a lot of the UX tools are, you know, they're great to conducting the interviews, capturing, doing the screen capture side of things and things like that, but they're not able to really, you know, a lot of them don't provide any transcriptions with the videos. They can't recognize key things that are happening within there. So we're starting to see a number of clients saying, hey, can we, you know, we've got all these videos from product X. Can we import them into your platform as an easier way to kind of understand what's being said, splice them together to share with the product team and things like that? Because, you know, as we've seen, you know, very regularly, there's loads of great platforms out there for capturing video. The challenge on most of these platforms is there's very little out there to be able to quickly understand it and take snippets of the output and turn it into something meaningful, which might be a 2 to 3 minute video that shows the pain points with the shopping cart. Like if you've done user testing, there's no real quick way on a lot of these platforms to splice up, okay, here's 5 examples of people getting stuck, you know, with our advanced product filter, you know, whereas within VoxBot.me, it's very quick and easy to do that. So yeah, there's some interesting things we're looking at and integrations into commonly used platforms like that.
So let's talk a little bit about the early days of VoxBot.me. What was your inspiration?
Yeah, so some of your listeners probably know, like we came into VoxBot.me with no research background experience, kind of stumbled into it. I'd been involved in building technology companies, platform that was very similar to Yelp.com, been involved in building mobile apps and all kinds of, you know, kind of early stage stuff. And I'd been at a conference and someone was presenting a social platform to change the world, as many of these pitches went back in those days. And it was all about how people could get behind different causes and convince brands not to do certain things. So maybe it was, you know, Nike, you shouldn't be having your trainers made in, you know, sneakers made in this particular country, or you should be paying your workers this, whatever it might be. And they were like, this is what we can do, and it's going to force brands to change. And one of the things you can do is post a video to the wall as to why you think. And I remember thinking to myself, and I said to the guy at the time, I was like, it's great, you're trying to save the world, but I think it's a huge opportunity you're missing in terms of the business model should be, how do you let people give feedback to brands via video? And video was such a, you know, growing medium at that point. You know, everyone was, you know, the iPhone, you know, we were in kind of second or third generation of the iPhone. So more and more everyone had a smartphone in their pocket. You know, things like FaceTime had just launched, you know, Facebook was moving more and more to video. So we just saw this opportunity to connect brands and consumers. And so initially we came up with the VoxPopMe app, which is still a big part of our business today, which was a, you know, on-demand app. You know, you want to get 100 responses from consumers in a couple of hours. You can push a question out, get those videos back really quickly, stuff. And I remember early in the journey, we were like, everyone's going to want to watch all these videos and really understand what customers were saying. And very quickly, we found out that, you know, no one had time to watch 100 customer feedback videos, and we needed to find a way to automate, you know, the analysis with, you know, things like transcription and themes and sentiment and things like that. But where we really kind of where things really changed was Manchester City Football Club in England asked if they could embed our technology into Vision Critical, the community platform at the time. And that kind of got us thinking about, okay, well, yeah, I mean, our business is great that we've got this app and some early interest, but it's kind of limited by how many people we have by the app, what countries we have the app in, and things like that. If we could power video questions on any platform, so whether you're using a, you know, Fuel Cycle, Qualtrics, Decipher, you know, Survey Gizmo, whatever platform you were using, if we could be the kind of intel inside to power video, that really was what changed the game. And we started to see more and more companies wanting to add video open-end questions into their surveys because they were so much kind of richer than the text alternative.
Did you encounter budget mapping issues early on? What I mean by that is, you know, traditional.
I wish it was early on.
Yeah. Okay. Good point.
You mean like you don't know? Yeah. You mean so like as in because it was something new that people hadn't really considered?
Precisely, right? Because you're not, you know, in a lot of ways you're doing qualitative in every way. You're doing qualitative at scale, and so you know you've got this this preconceived notion of how research is done. I'm going to do this qualitative. I'm going to do a survey. I'm going to have an answer or whatever. And what you've done is effectively created either another cog or replaced an existing cog. In either case, it's definitely a change of behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I think this has been talked about on the podcast a number of times, how difficult change is to implement and drive within the industry. And, you know, there's lots of reasons, you know, behind that, you know, kind of, you know, the status quo and professional risk and what if it doesn't work. And as a, you know, as an industry, we're not, you know, we tend to be typically a bit more risk averse. So yeah, I mean, it was tough in the early days for sure. I think what we found was that once customers found, you know, we had a relatively low entry point in terms of how you could get started. And then once customers presented findings internally, and all of a sudden, rather than people sat looking at their phones, you know, scrolling through Facebook while they were doing their readout, people leaned in and leaned forward and was like, hang on, this, you know, like that customer's just said this or this is in there. All of a sudden, that was the kind of wow moment for our clients was, you know, for the ones that had done video previously, who told and labored all weekend to try and find what the insights was in the data and try and, you know, use, you know, very, very basic video editing skills and then try and download a video and then it didn't play in their presentation. So the wow moment for them was how easy we'd made it. But for a lot of clients who hadn't experienced using video, what they found was when they presented those insights, they were just so much more, there was so much more buy-in from stakeholders and executives because, again, they were hearing that message directly from the customer. It wasn't an interpretation. It was the customer delivering it in their own words. And you know, when you combine that output with, you know, statistically significant, you know, robust quant behind it, and you had this kind of hybrid methodology, that was powerful. But it's still something we come across today because, you know, is it an alternative to how they're doing qual already? Is it a faster, more agile way to do qual? Is it something that adds cost to their quant, but actually, you know, means that they maybe can do everything in one study. And, you know, it's still a challenge today for sure.
One of the key themes that has emerged is the importance of storytelling And I'm kind of going back a little bit to what you had talked about in terms of skills between soft and science skills. And in this framework, as Q plus Q is qualitative and quantitative are being blended more and more to enhance ultimately the stats so that they can be consumed, understood and consumed by the organization that then affects change. Video, of course, is playing a pivotal role in that storytelling. Are you doing a lot in terms of educating your users on how to effectively craft and then tell stories?
Yeah, I think we're definitely trying to help them, create that narrative and take that data and you know what is the best way to present this in a compelling way, and how do you, because with video it's very it's very important that usually you're going to take a handful of video clips make a certain point, pick a couple more clips that make a certain point to build out that overall story. And what you've got to be careful of is that message that you're delivering and story that you're curating is actually the story that's in the data. Because with just a handful of video clips, it could be very easy to misrepresent the story that was in the data. So we're starting to do a lot of work with that around automation. So being able to summarize efficiently 100 videos and condense that down into 3-4 minutes of content that really accurately represents what was said in that whole corpus of responses. So we're trying to educate both how researchers can stitch together video clips to tell a story in a way that's going to connect emotionally and resonate with the audience and drive home that point, but also trying to look at ways where automation can start to build on some of those stories and kind of really bring that to life.
How many employees do you have now, about?
I should know this, right? We're just over 50 now.
Oh, that's great. A tectonic shift in a for a CEO. I don't know what it is. There's something magical from 49 to 51 that happens, right? I mean, there's this whole new layer of complexity, it feels like. What do you see as the three characteristics of an all-star employee?
Yeah, so I mean, I think like hiring is everything, right? I mean, you can have the best technology in the world, but if you have crap people, you're going to have a crap company. So, finding those all-star employees is the most thing. And it's the thing that keeps me up at night. I know we can build good tech and stuff, and just, finding good people and nurturing them and bringing them on as individuals and as a team is obviously, one of the biggest focuses you can have as a CEO. So I would say the three things that I look for when I'm interviewing people, curiosity. I think that's massive. I think there's not enough people these days that are curious. They don't always search out answers. So we're really looking for people who are, they find solutions, they question everything, they're constantly asking why, how do I make this better, and they've got their own initiative to get on with that. So I think curiosity is massive. Hustle. It's become a bit of, I guess, an overused word in the entrepreneurial circle of, you got to hustle. But I mean, it's true. You want people who, they don't wait for, they don't kind of always look for permission. They'd much rather do something and try something and fail, than seek forgiveness. So they're always kind of going out, they're hunting down the opportunity, they're looking to solve problems, and they just want to get shit done.
I like that. Curiosity to action to resolution. That is one of the core tenets, I believe, of a successful life. If you can be just naturally curious, but then not stop there, but actually seek out the answers. And you think about it, really, in a lot of ways, that's exactly what researchers do, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've got it. Yeah, you know, best researchers are curious and they put that to action. And then you asked for free. So the final one was just, you know, having that customer focus. You know, they put themselves in our customers' shoes and they look, they're constantly looking for that kind of win-win outcome, you know, which is back to that kind of solution focus, curiosity, hustle.
So over 50 employees now. Very successful company, great brand inside of the market research space. What is one of your secrets that drives growth, profitability, or the success of a company?
Yeah, so, as I said, I mean, obviously it starts with people, but, you know, once you've found good people, essentially you've got to really trust them and empower them to get on and do stuff. And the only way that you can trust them and empower them to do stuff is make sure they understand the vision. So, you know, one of the key things for our team is making sure from, you know, myself all the way down through the organization that people people really understand what we've got now, where we're trying to get to in the short, medium, and long term, and how that's evolving. And, you know, and in a, you know, in an early stage company, as you know, I'm sure you can appreciate, given the journey with Decipher, you know, that's constantly evolving. And, you know, you've got to bring people with you on that journey, because you can't silo an executive team away and be like, well, we've got to hit this number, or we've got to ship this product, or we've got to do this. If that whole team isn't kind of rowing together towards that goal, you're just going to kind of tread water. So, you know, the key thing has really been, you know, and that's tough, you know, with ourselves. You know, we've got people in Sydney and Australia. We've got a big team in the US. Half the people are in the UK. So, and, you know, we've got people spread out over a lot of different offices and remote working and stuff. So being able to bring those people together regularly, make them feel part of something, has been huge.
What is your sequencing to that? Are you doing a monthly all hands or through email?
Yeah, so one of the things I do is a weekly video, kind of 3 minute, kind of, you know, the state of play, things that have happened, call people out who've done great things, and just update them on the journey. We have a very transparent culture. You know, people within the company know how much revenue we did. They know what our churn rate is. They know what big deals have closed, what big deals we won, what big deals we lost, who we're hiring for. So I think that culture of transparency. So that video is kind of like the soundbite, just kind of keep everyone on there. And again, it's not always me that does that. It, you know, some weeks it's Tom, our CRO, Andy, our CTO, different people across that executive team. And then, yeah, we tend to have kind of monthly all hands where people dial into. And then we'll also do, you know, with smaller teams, quite a lot of kind of offsites together. Usually that's more of a functional team. So maybe the dev team will all get together and spend some time, or the sales and marketing organization will all get together. We're yet to have a kind of all company retreat. I always see Zappy do that each year and stuff, and it looks, Ryan said it's one of the best things they do each year and stuff. So we're looking at implementing something like that. It just trying to logistically get 50 people into one place and is never easy.
It's really difficult to do that logistically. On top of it, it can be really disruptive to your core customers, right? Because that means that there's some level of service that may be sacrificed, perhaps increased delays in responsiveness, et cetera. And that was one of my bigger challenges when I would do a corporate retreat or, you know, take R&D out or whatever. You know, it basically shuts down that division, or you run the risk of alienating a subset of the employees that keep, you know, the skeleton crew that keeps the ship afloat while everybody else is out having a good time.
Yeah, and it's something that we've been conscious of. As I say, historically we've done that as you know, small teams or geographic groups of people. So we've never kind of had that kind of all company within there. But I think you've just got to try and structure that. But ultimately, I think there's things, measures and that you can put in place to mitigate against some of that. But it's about, if constantly everyone's working in the business, it's back to, one of the big changes I've made personally over the last 12 months is, how do you as a leader kind of try and pull yourself out of the day-to-day to, focus on, like real visions, more strategic things. I think it's important that's not just a, CEO challenge, that actually right across the company, everyone starts to think about that. Yeah, everyone's got their day job, but if people are just heads down five days a week, 40 hours a week, whatever that is, then people need time to think. And I think giving people some thinking time and some space, great things can happen.
I love that. So what is BotPopMe offering right now that can add value to brands?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, we've been absolutely laser focused on video and how do we remove that pain from video. The thing I'm probably most excited about at the moment is we've made a big push into customer experience and kind of when I think about customer experience, for me that's an industry where today it's still reliant on this survey instrument. We're trying to understand people's experiences with brands by forcing them through a very structured 15 to 20 question survey about, rating every facet of the business. And, ultimately, this is where video really plays a role. When you're talking about an experience, that's an emotional connection, at a, journey point within there. So, for us, that's about kind of allowing people to give feedback to brands, directly through video, and moving away from everything being about scores and moving more into what are those customer stories. So we've got a big focus on customer experience for sure. And then ultimately, when brands are looking to do qualitative research in a more agile way, and turn projects around in 2 to 3 hours, VoxPopMe is the company to call for sure.
Do you think that VoxPopMe in some ways, or the utilization of video more broadly, is cannibalizing traditional focus groups or IDIs, or do you feel like it is overall augmenting the budgets or budgets being bolstered in order to support this added benefit?
Yeah, I mean, I think that any kind of new technology, kind of will always start to cannibalize a little bit of some part of the industry in some way. But for the main, it's not kind of I'm going to do this or this. It's I'm going to I'm going to augment. I'm going to do more. I think innovation in research has allowed people to do, more with less, more faster. They're not spending any less money. They're just doing more research. So I think what VoxPopMe enables people to do is think and iterate, more quickly, rather than, so it's about kind of how do you iterate faster, rather than do more research and ask more questions rather than, cannibalizing what they're already doing.
Are company firms like Firefly or, different major players in the qualitative space, is that one of the big channel strategies for growth for you? Or is growth stemming more from brand relationships and deeper penetration?
Yeah, I mean, for us as a company, we definitely kind of cross both sides of that. We have very strong relationships with the Kantars, the Nielsens, and the large agencies who are embedding our technology into different programs that they're doing. Likewise, a lot of brands work directly with us. So we've from day one had this dual channel strategy. I think when you talk to on the brand side of things, often that can, come alongside, the need for professional services and, talking with Braden, our SVCP of customer success, who Jamie, of course, well, that was one of the challenges, and you guys had with, you know, during Decipher was how did you support that professional services or not? And yeah, that's definitely something that we've been looking at is, you know, when we, you know, as we expand and we do more with brands, you know, we absolutely want to stay as a technology vendor and a technology solution that can be used in a DIY manner or used by agencies for their clients. So we don't want to kind of fall into the trap of becoming a research agency. I mean, I think we've seen that story happen to a number of technology players in the space, and it doesn't end too well.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a trade-off of, you know, short-term boost to your P&L, but yep, long-term value degradation. And you're absolutely right. I think everybody that's entered into that or made those transitions has paid a price ultimately for it. And I'm not going to go through the names, of course, but there is an inherent benefit of having services integrated into your technology solutions. You know, one of the challenges, though, beyond just the support side, is the overall valuation of the company. But if you're thinking about what's best for the customer, I believe you always, you know, you always attain that best possible outcome for your business, whether it's just, you know, continual growth or eventual sale. It's all about putting the customer in the middle of those decisions.
Yeah, and we've took a strategic approach to that. You know, there's you talked about the cannibalization and of maybe things like focus groups and IDIs and in person. You know, we're actually kind of doing some really exciting work in that space where, you know, we're not going to get into that space, but our solution layered on top of what existing vendors in that arena are doing can add some real value and stickiness. So actually, in person becomes, you know, even more useful through the addition and augmentation of combining that with technology. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity out there, and you know, we've been a very kind of pro partnership company.
My guest today has been Dave Carruthers, founder and CEO of VoxPopMe. Dave, thank you very much for being on the Happy Market Research podcast.
Thanks, Jamin.
Next time on Happy Market Research, Ricardo Alvarez Diaz, head of insights for MasterCard. Ton of value relevant to doing business in Latin America, and probably the most impactful episode we've had so far about how to do storytelling inside of a brand. If you're an agency or you're employed at a brand, you absolutely have to listen to this. This creates a rubric for success.